Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo and I've got Dawn with me this evening.
Good evening.
And it's a pleasure to welcome to VI Talk for the first time, Mike Brace, who is a Paralympian, no less, who now campaigns and does lots of public speaking, but has done many, many other things which will come out throughout the interview. So hiya, Mike.
Hi, pleased to be Mike. Here. Hi there.
Lovely to have you. So if we go right back to the start, do you want to tell us a little bit about your how you lost your sight, Mike, and what your visual impairment is?
Yeah, that really was where a lot of the things did start. I was a 10-year-old living in Hackney, very much involved in my sport and playing football and cricket and athletics. Not too bad academically. I think if I'd have got to sit the 11 plus in those days, I might have passed and potentially gone to a grammar school. And then in the half-term holidays in November, I was playing football over the local park, saw some kids gathered around one end. Being a bit of a nosy 10-year-old, I went up and said, "What are you doing?" They told me to get lost. I ignored what they were saying. And what they were looking at was a black medicine bottle on the floor with the lid screwed on. So being a 10-year-old, bit braver, I bent down and picked the bottle up just as the banger inside it blew up. So I got badly cut in the face. One eye was badly cut. Picked myself up, went home, got rid of some of the blood, and then got carried off to the, taken up by a neighbour to the local hospital. They saw it was serious and transferred me to Moorfields. They then stitched the injured eye up. But at that stage, the good eye hadn't been injured. And then over a period of a few months, I developed a thing called sympathetic ophthalmia and uveitis in the good eye. And the sight basically went to nothing. But I still had a bit of sight in the eye that was injured. And then when I was about 12 and a half, something like that, I was supporting my football team and wanted to make as much noise as possible. So I blew a bugle that I managed to grab from somewhere. And unfortunately, the pressure of blowing the trumpet then, or the bugle, hemorrhaged the back of the eye and detached the retina. And I literally woke up totally blind the following morning. So, you know, a pretty difficult journey. And at that stage, when I was 10, I'd never remember ever meeting someone with sight loss. I don't think anyone in our family had sight loss. And it was something that I was obviously not prepared for whatsoever.
Must have been a heck of a shock. Massive shock. To deal with, and obviously your family as well. And it's, you know.
Very much so. And that journey was difficult because, and as many of your listeners will appreciate, you know, people have got some really funny ideas about sight loss. And if you can't see, they think you can't hear as well. So yeah. I remember very early getting on the bus and people would say, "Oh, poor little so-and-so." And I'd say to my mum, "Hello, who's got on the bus then? Who are we feeling sorry for?" And it turned out to be me they were talking about. And I suppose in some ways that was like a red rag to a bull, because I thought, how dare you? How dare you make assumptions about me and my abilities without knowing anything about me? And that was probably a good kick that I needed. But you're right, you doubt yourself. I wasn't sure how well I was adapting to my sight loss, so I was competitive with my peers, so I wanted to get as good as some of the blind kids that I was mixing with. I wanted to get as good as they were at sport and various things. My family obviously were struggling, so I was at a boarding school, so they didn't really have the day-to-day stuff with me to adapt and acclimatise. And then you had the public. So four areas, really: yourself, your peers, your family and the public were really stacked up against you a bit.
Mm. So you went to boarding school, I'm guessing, for specialist education.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happened after that? Did you go on to college, university?
No one in my family had gone into further education, so that really wasn't an option. And whilst I think I did really well at the school in terms of adapting, and the sport was very prominent there, but unfortunately the educational attainment was pretty poor. I think this is in the 60s, 67, thereabouts. I think I ended up with the most qualifications in the history of the school, which was 2 O levels and a grade 1 CSE. So that really wasn't going to do very much for me in terms of job prospects. And again, some of your listeners will remember, in those days, blind people were largely grouped. You know, someone had a view of your attainment level or what you were fit for, really. So, you know, if you were supposedly in the sort of bright end of it, you possibly went and did the law or physiotherapy or something like that. And then the second group were either a shorthand typist, an audio typist, a telephonist, or you went into a factory or a piano tuner. And I was deemed to be one of those. So I went and did shorthand at Pembridge Place, which was the shorthand college in London at that stage. Did my year there and got my shorthand, and then got a job in the civil service, which was a struggle, really. I mean, I went in there when I was 18 and realised really within about 2 weeks that I was in the wrong job.
So how did you deal with that? What sort of it sounds to me, I mean, you've definitely got a very positive attitude, haven't you? You know, you're not going to take anything lying down, I'm guessing. So you're going to be quite proactive, I would imagine. So what did you do at that point when you realised this is not the job for me?
Well, it was a struggle because, again, you've got this expectation. So, you know, if you tell someone they'll never achieve anything or do anything often enough, they tend to start to believe it. And so I didn't have many people around me mentoring or saying, you know, you can do more than this and everything else. In many ways, you were almost the reverse. People saying, look, you know, you've really done well. You've got a job. Don't rock the boat. Be thankful for it. But you're right. It just wasn't me. I mean, civil service, as I said once before, I wasn't very civil and I was no one's servant. And and I was in a typing pool with 20 women. And in those days, you know, I had to literally formally ask permission of the room to take my jacket off in case it offended someone's sensitivities. This is not early 70s, you know, it's not the dark ages. But so I decided that I needed to do something. You're right. And so I did a A-level English correspondence course. And one of the ex-teachers said that she would help me with some of the more difficult bits like the Chaucer and various other things. And I travelled from my home then in Hackney and Enfield over to Sutton in London to have these extra lessons. It was all done by correspondence course. So basically everything was in print. There was very little in Braille or audio. So I had to get various people like my wife and stuff to read me all the information. So I got the English A-level and then decided I would then go and do a sociology A-level. And my wife and I then went to an evening class in Blackfriars in London to the evening classes. My wife then mainly wrote all the notes down because although I could do shorthand, it was easier for her to write the notes for herself as well. And then I sat the exam and she didn't bother in the end. And I managed to get the A-level in sociology as well. So that with 2 A-levels then meant I could apply to go on a social work course at the what was the North London Polytechnic, which is now the London University. And basically that started me on the social work career path then.
What would you advise people now who are looking to go into social work? Because I know a lot of visually impaired people look to go down that route of being a social worker. What would you advise them?
I think it was a wonderful choice for me. I'm not sure whether it's easier or more difficult now with the advent of technology. Certainly you need good written skills because obviously you've got to be able to write notes and court reports or, you know, major various things like that. Mobility obviously is a key issue. In those days as well, there wasn't any concept or any possibility of having any sort of personal assistance. And again, I'd be interested from your listeners to know how that works now, because if the personal assistant isn't formally employed by the local authority, how are they cleared confidential wise to go into someone's home and, I don't know, deal with child abuse or whatever when they're not potentially then bound by the local authority's confidentiality issues? So I'd be really interested. I did post this on the postings once just to check that out. But it was a fantastic option, and it meant that you could give rather than always feeling that you were being regarded as a disadvantaged or disabled or unable person. You were actually there, hopefully helping and contributing to others. And that for me was a massive boost to self-confidence, etc.
Amazing. So where did the sport come in?
Well, parallel bits of it really was when I was at school, I was involved in sport at all levels really with at the boarding school. And then I left age 17, went to Pembridge, did my stuff, and then 18 plus, went home, absolutely nothing. No organised sport. There was one London sports club at that stage who was a bit sort of a bit limited in its thinking and the sort of things that it was wanting to do. It was largely catering from an older age group of members who wanted, I suppose, more traditional things like rambling and various other bits and pieces. Whereas we were sort of full of young Turks, as it were, wanted more to do. So rather than moan about it, we then got together, eight of us, and formed a sports club called Metro, which is still going today, nearly 50 years later.
Yeah.
And that's now got hundreds of members, thousands of hits on the website. And we started then to do athletics and football and cricket. And then we got an invitation to go skiing in Norway in 1974. And I thought they were absolutely bonkers. You know, the notion of blind people on skis, I just couldn't conceptualise. But we were told that the Norwegian blind were taking to it quite a lot. And I thought, well, if anything, if the blind in Norway can do it, then so can we. So off 15 of us went, and I just got the bug. You know, it was just fantastic. It's cross-country skiing. And suddenly you've got a whole total freedom of movement. Normally you're, you know, behind a guide dog or a white stick or, you know, linking in with someone. Whereas on skis, you're just totally free and out in the elements. And for me, that was just amazing. And then you've got a guide who becomes almost an honorary vision impaired person, because they really do start to act as your eyes and almost know what it's like not to be able to see, because they're seeing for you. And so some of those friendships have just lasted again for 50 years. And that was it. And I was able then, because I was working, to still train and do various other sports at weekends. And when I was doing a residential social work job, that was quite funny as well, because it was a prison unit for adolescent girls in Hackney, and at the last minute, the major secure unit was not licensed. So we had this enormous exercise yard with a 20-foot high brick wall. And when I was on night duty, I could then go and run round this this bricked enclosure, and someone phoned from the flats overlooking saying, there's a madman in the pen, he's trying to get out, could you go and let him out? Which was brilliant. Was me, you know, it did feel a bit like that.
Love it, brilliant.
So how was you, did you, for your skiing and things, did you get funding with for that? Did you have to fund that yourself? And how did you find your guide to do that and things?
Well, the funding was very much down to us to organise. So when we started to just do it as a holiday, then obviously it was just your own personal finance. And then when we started to ski properly, 1977, we went over there and I met an amazing guy called Rolf Willemsen, and he was then the managing director of ICI, the chemical place in Norway and Scandinavia. And he and I got on really well, and he, you know, took the fact that I really was committed. So he started to help support and fund the ski team. And he then recruited his son and various other people to act as our guides. And we've been so fortunate then for the next 20 odd years. We ended up with top class Norwegian skiing guides through that initial introduction. And then that's how basically I started after dinner speaking in the 70s, early 80s, really was to raise money for the ski team and other charities. And so we started then to do more and more events and activities to raise the money. And then in 1983, we had this mad idea, and it was pretty mad, that we would do three sports in 30 days to raise the money to go over to the next games in 1984 in three different sports. And we'd all been skiers, so we chose skiing as one of the events. The second year of the London Marathon, so we thought, oh, well, we'll run the London Marathon. And then someone said, oh, about canoeing, because, you know, blind people, all you've got to do is sit in the canoe. So I said, well, oh, we'll do that then. And someone mentioned the Devizes to Westminster Canoe Marathon, which I thought, that sounds all right. You've only got to sit in a boat and paddle. What I didn't realise, it was 125 miles non-stop. Wow. It was from on April Fool's Day. So that could tell you that basically there were other April Fools around. And the event included a thing called a portage, which was where you pick the canoe up, hold it over your head, run round the obstacle, put it back in the water, and then start paddling again. So I thought, well, that's a bit. Then I realised there were 72 portages to do, and one of which was a mile and a quarter round. So you were running with a canoe over your head with a guide. Worst conditions in the history of the race. So it was snowing and hailstones. And of the 182 crews that started it, there were three crews that were with blind and partially sighted rowers. Of the 182 that started it, 82 finished, so 100 dropped out because of the conditions, and we were 41st, so we managed to beat the SAS and the boat services. Well done. And wow. So we were just, but it did take me 27 hours, 21 minutes non-stop.
That was incredible. Well done.
That is amazing.
So you can see, yeah, the sport has been a bit of a plus in my life, but it's had its moments.
Absolutely demonstrates your sheer determination, I think, that.
Absolutely, definitely. I think most of us would have packed up and gone home, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
And And I think strangely as well, doing the social work that I was then doing, because I was doing stuff in the East End, and then it was largely work with adolescents and children, child protection, children in care. Having had the odd, glitch in your own life, and had the odd challenge to deal with, like losing your sight, it really did give you a bit of an affinity with people then facing their own challenges, whether it be, disability, poverty, or whatever, mental health. Mm. And it really did give you not an insight, but it just gave you a chance to understand how a bit of help might actually mean a big difference in their lives if they could get it.
Yeah. So how many Paralympics or Winter Olympics did you attend, Mike?
I competed in 5 Winter Paralympics, and then I managed a further 4. So I did 9 Winter Paralympics, and then towards the end of that, I helped set up the Paralympic Association in London, in Great Britain, and then I ended up chairing it from 2001 to 2009. And therefore, I was then going as the chef de mission and the head of service to another 4 summer games then as well. So I went to, from Sydney, Athens, and then through to Beijing.
Now, I understand you have written some books as well, haven't you? Would you like to tell us a little bit about your books?
Yeah. It was about trying to, challenge perceptions and challenge minds by, the after dinner stuff is getting people to laugh with me at their own attitudes in the comfort and privacy of their own minds. So no one else would know that they were thinking stupid thoughts or silly thoughts or whatever. And so book one is called Where There's a Will. And basically it covers going blind at 10, and then right the way through the challenges of trying to get a job or access to technology, or the funny things that then you had to laugh at rather than cry at that we've all done, the stupid things, the odd shoes, from different pair of shoes and different colours, through to more drastic ones of major embarrassment situations that you've gone through, and so book one really just covers that first sort of 20 or 30 years, and some of the things that occurred. And then book two is called Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog, and that really came about from for many years, I said I didn't want to get a guide dog. I wouldn't get a guide dog. And then when I was coming up to retirement, I think the environments gradually got worse in terms of, obstacles and barriers and stuff like that. And I started to think, look, perhaps a dog might be an option. And succumbed and got my first guide dog in 2010. And the title of the book really came from that, because I couldn't believe that the people, instead of the assumptions about me and my abilities, very often they had the same similar stupid views about my dog's abilities. And, does he read the traffic lights, or does he, has he got a sat nav or whatever, And when I answered, they still didn't believe me. And I said, well, all right, don't ask me, ask the dog, he'll tell you, sort of thing. And so that's how and that covers really from 1981, 82, right the way through to just after I retired in 2012 and up to sort of 2013, 2014. And they're both on R&B Talking Books. I think Calibre have got them as well. But they're also on Amazon, on print, and on Kindle. So, and then what I do is, with any money I get in from that, then I give to the different charities that I'm involved with. So it's for me, it's another way of being able to give something back from some of the fantastic opportunities that I've had through through work. Obviously, I then helped set up and ran Vision 2020 UK. So that brought me back into working in the vision impairment sector, which I'd never done. And that was almost a full circle, really, of losing your sight, not working in and having much to do other than through the sport in the vision impaired world, back then into the vision impaired world to retirement.
What was that like, helping to set up Vision 2020? That must have been quite interesting.
It was, because, I mean, you know, and I've got to be careful what I say, but the disability world is pretty fractioned and fractured in some bits of it. Mm-hmm. And the blind world and the vision impairment world was very, very competitive, and many of the big charities, they wouldn't speak to each other or couldn't really, you know, have a dialogue with each other. And then I realised there were 733 registered charities for the blind and partially sighted in the UK.
Wow.
And I thought, well, it's no wonder we can't get any traction and any movement on all the key things, you know, unemployment of people of working age who are vision impaired are still 80-odd% or 90% are unemployed. Access to technology, access to information, it's just all the barriers there. So it struck me that, you know, we could get something that tried to span across the voluntary sector, the statutory sector, the health sector. And that's what Vision 2020 did for its life, and you know, and that was fantastic. It got the ophthalmologists and the optometrists in room together, because I didn't realise that they at one stage didn't really speak to each other or wouldn't work together. So us then bringing it all into one grouping really did get some incredible traction and some major achievements, and 34 national charities then all joined Vision 2020, and some of them were on our trustee board, etc. And that really did start to get a forum of collaboration and working together that hadn't been seen, I don't think, in the VI sector for a very, very long time, if ever.
And it should be all about working together and achieving the same goals, really, shouldn't it?
It is. And it's about the outcomes. Exactly. Yeah. We want the outcomes that, you know, they're very basic, many things. You know, why is it still some websites are not accessible? You know, why do we still at times feel as though we're an addition or a nuisance or an add-on rather than inclusion or you know, a valued member of society?
Yeah. Very much so.
You know, I think Vision 2020 started to try and address some of that, and with its demise last year, which ironically in 2020, which is when it was supposed to be, I think, have achieved all its goals. I'm pleased to say that there are still now collaborative groupings starting to come together and working more collaboratively together. And hopefully that will last. And of course, we didn't have really social media platforms. And again, that's where the VI Talk, I think, has, you know, I thought I was going to be a bit too old to get involved with VI Talk. And then suddenly, you know, there were some incredibly interesting things being pointed forward, or people raising the things that I raised 50 or 60 years ago for the first time. And starting all over. And I just thought that was an amazing opportunity to listen to people's perspectives now and or perhaps add 5 pennyworth in and say, well, you know, that's a really interesting, but have you thought of this as well?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what it's all about, sharing. Supporting each other. Peer support is incredibly important, I think.
Yes. And if you're... You know, I've been so fortunate as to be employed for all my working life, which is so rare in terms of the you know, average experience of many people with a vision impairment. I've met some amazing people through the sport and through the various things that I've been doing. And those opportunities, you know, hopefully can get that sort of traction in terms of the wider community. And, you know, and the sport, I still try and do me cricket. I still organise skiing trips. So if anyone, listeners are interested in coming to Norway next year, it's March, I think, 14th or 13th, over to Norway. Never too old. There's an American there who's 95 and competes wow. over there. And it's for beginners. And it's a wonderful, wonderful experience, at least to try once. And once you've done it once, then you'll want to do it more and more. I think I mentioned in the email that I just had the, I just overwhelmingly wonderful experience of getting featured on This Is Your Life with by Eamon Andrews. And one of the, you know, you had a few celebrities coming on there, but the key people there were my two ski guides. So the guy that taught me to ski in the 70s came on from Norway. And then the guy that I mentioned from ICI, he came on the program. And it was just unbelievable. And I've been in a folk groups and had people from my two folk groups on there as well. And that was just overwhelming. And I was still very young, so I thought, well, is that it then? Have I finished? You know, have I done it? And but thank goodness I didn't think that and carried on. But yeah.
So bringing it up now to present dates, what are you doing with yourself now?
Right. I'm still organising the ski trips. So this is the, I think I've been organising them since 1974. So this is about my 46th, 7th year. I'm thinking about doing a third book. I've got a second guide dog now who's very different from the first one, and his name's King, K-I-N-G. So I've already got the title of the book, The King and I. So I'm thinking of doing that. And he's a very clever dog. He's already does blogs or proclamations, he calls them, and he sends them out on the email to 200 or 300 people. My other dog's got a Facebook page, so she's into the social media, but he just does his proclamations. So I'm going to do that. I'm on two or three committees still, which again, I'm hoping that I can carry on doing that for a little bit longer. And, you know, keeping fit, going then back to the gym, hopefully once lockdown's finally finished, and just keeping the fitness ticking over. And then obviously, it's been interesting. I've been doing, during the pandemic now, I've been doing two or three charity fundraising after dinner talks on Zoom, which is very disconcerting because you can't see the audience, you can't hear them either. And occasionally I've just wondered if I've been cut off, you know, and the Wi-Fi has gone down, but you don't know. So I'm doing some charity ones. I did one for two or three charities. I'm doing one for our local hospice next month, and I'm hoping that I could raise a thousand or two from that. And then once it starts back again, I'll probably do some after dinner stuff in various sort of corporate things as and when they're back having live type events, and then that will start to regenerate the money going back in to the charities. Yeah, so, you know, it's enough to tick over, and I've had to do the gardening, which I'm not really that keen on, but someone's got to do it. And so I've been out doing gardening and weeding and all that sort of stuff just to maintain things.
Fabulous. You're a very busy
man. Keeping yourself busy then.
Yeah. I, hopefully for a bit longer. I mean, I'm in my 70s now, so it just means that you want to keep fit and keep on going.
Brilliant. What we didn't Great ask attitude. You, and I know all the listeners are going to be shouting, you didn't ask him how he did in the Paralympics, so we need to ask that question.
I got fourth in the relay. I got seventh in the biathlon, which is skiing and shooting, So you ski, you lay down on the floor with a rifle and you shoot at a target with an optical sight with an oscillator in your ear. You ski and then you go on again. So that was seventh in that and fourth in the relay. And I think my best individual position in the general stuff was about eight or ninth. But the relay was always my big event because it was being a team person was always more for me than and getting the others to, you know, we had my colleagues were winning medals and stuff like that. So it was supporting them almost because I was managing as well as skiing. It meant that basically at times you had to not sacrifice, but you had to let go of your own ski performances in order to ensure that someone was better mentally prepared, or if they had a break in confidence, that you could deal with that, or the guides or whatever. Yeah. And so I was managing as well as skiing for most of those trips.
Fabulous. Sounds amazing. You've had such an amazing journey, Mike, and long may it continue.
Absolutely, well, yeah.
And thank you very much for the opportunity to share that, because again, there's some wonderful people out there just starting off, and you know, the message really is, you know, that you're the biggest arbitrator of what you can achieve. You know, if you don't have the confidence, you don't have the will, then basically it's going to be tough. But you know, keep on thinking that, and also if we can start to carry on challenging the perceptions, because when I finish my talks, I always say, because for me, disability is a state of mind, my state and your mind. You can't do much about my state, but hopefully I've done something about your mind. And that's the issue, is getting people to change the way they think.
Yeah,
that's a brilliant way to close. Yeah. Thank you so much, Mike. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thank you. Thank you.